Welcome to the final episode of Series 1 of CityWire Switzerland's Thanks I Quit podcast. I'm Fergus Horsfall and our guest today is Paul Donovan, Chief Economist of UBS Global Wealth Management. The series has covered finance workers with interesting career changes. However, this final episode flips that around and covers how the industry has changed during Paul's career, specifically in terms of attitude to LGBTQ plus issues. Paul, how has the banking world changed in this context? And thank you for joining me.
Well, the change has been fairly dramatic, I think. But it's also, of course, reflecting the change in society, or at least in many societies as well, that society has become more inclusive and banking, finance generally has become more inclusive as part of that process. I mean, when I started my career over 30 years ago as an intern in the City of London, there was absolutely no way I was going to be out in my career. That would have ended my career. There was no question. And what you found was that there were very, very few queer individuals in the financial sector who were out. They tended to be people who essentially had reached the pinnacle of their career and felt that it couldn't negatively affect them. And so you had this environment which was very oppressive. It was very stressful. You were constantly self-censoring yourself and editing yourself. I mean, it was a really quite an unpleasant environment in the financial markets. But as time has gone on, the financial system, of course, is very, very dependent on what, as an economist, I would refer to as human capital. But of course, what we mean is we need skills. We need good quality people. That's what finance is built on. And I think that has helped to make finance actually quite a leading part of the drive towards diversity and inclusion, because I think quite early on, the financial industry realized that actually, we need people based on their skills, based on their talents, and irrelevant prejudices need to be pushed aside, and we need to create an environment where people are allowed to be themselves, to bring their best possible game to work. And so what we've seen over the last 30 years is some really significant strides towards improving diversity and inclusion in general. But the LGBTQ plus community has specifically benefited from that.
So it was clear to you then that you could not come out?
It was, the signals around it were pretty clear. So I interned at an organization, UBS, a different bank. And I can remember being taken to one side by the desk assistant whilst I was an intern there and being told, don't speak to that person. He's gay. So you shouldn't speak to him. And so, of course, the message is quite clear. If I come out of the closet, then no one's going to talk to me. Yeah, and I'm going to be some kind of sort of pariah on the trading floor at that time. Of course, the assistant didn't realize that I'd have been rushing over to get the guy's phone number if only mobile phones had been invented at that time. It wasn't necessarily that you would lose your job for being queer in the late 80s or the early 90s, although that did happen. And of course, it was legal to happen in many, many countries. It was just that you would be shunned. You would not be part of the sort of informal networks that are so important.
Paul, are there any particular people, either in the banking industry or the corporate world, or even just in society as a whole, that you think really drove that change?
I think it's a complicated question, because we saw a change in society at large, and that was driven by a number of factors, including changing approaches after the AIDS pandemic, which was important. But you also saw a change in terms of culture, and people like Michael Cashman, who is a British politician, had been a British actor, very important in driving a change within culture, had the first on-screen gay kiss in British television in a soap opera. So that sort of thing changed the external environment. And then internally, I think what changed within finance was a mix. So in the early stages, it was allies. And I think the role of allies, particularly for the LGBTQ plus community, is exceptionally important. People who were not LGBTQ plus themselves coming up and saying, actually, you know, I'm a supporter of treating people equally. I'm supporter of treating human beings as if they're human beings. You know, fairly basic stuff like that. But by coming out and saying that, starting to change the climate. And UBS had an allies program very early on. And I think, I hope, it made a difference to a lot of people. And then later on, you start to get role models coming out. Now, that's been something which has been a little bit less for my generation. I mean, there were some high prominent, highly profiled business leaders like Lord Brown of BP who came out, although, of course, Lord Brown was forced out by the tabloid media. But having been forced out, then did become a very powerful advocate. But I often say that actually for someone of my generation, a lot of the people who've been really influential are, you know, Generation Z. It's the younger generation who I look at and see their confidence and assurance and just how comfortable they are in themselves. And actually, it's the younger generation, I think, that has been very influential for people of my generation in being more open about who we are.
So you think there are many people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s who it's getting easier for because of teenagers?
Essentially, yes. You know, Generation Z is going to save the world one TikTok dance at a time. And, you know, that is what is happening, I think. We are seeing these younger people come in. And I remark on this all the time. And I still catch myself self-censoring. And I know I shouldn't. And you know, I haven't been in the closet for years. But, you know, somebody asked me about, oh, what does your wife think? And, you know, my response tends to be, oh, I'm not married. Not, you know, I haven't found a man stupid enough to marry me yet. And so that sort of self-censorship, I still catch myself doing it. And yet I see, you know, younger colleagues who are, you know, out and proud about who they are and very, very open in discussions. And that, for me, it's very positive. I'm delighted to see it, but it's also a reminder that I need to learn. It's reverse mentoring, I suppose, in action.
Do you sometimes find that younger queer people in the business world don't fully understand what it was like for you in your era and sort of presume it was easier than it was?
I'm not sure that there's a belief that it was easier than it was. I don't think that necessarily is the case. I think that there are now more and more attempts, actually particularly in the last few years, to improve education within the wider queer community about the struggles. And of course, it's not just, you know, the younger generation that need to learn their history. You know, I may be getting on a bit, but I was not around for the Stonewall riots, and learning the history of Stonewall or the Madison Society or the Polari, the secret language of the gay male community in the UK in the 1940s and the 1950s. You know, that sort of history is important. I think it is very important. I think that there is perhaps certain areas where there's not necessarily a lack of understanding. It's quite difficult to comprehend. Here in the UK, we recently had a Channel 4 documentary, Channel 4 docudrama called It's a Sin, which was about the HIV/AIDS pandemic in the 1980s and the way that people were treated. And it's a terribly, terribly moving, terribly, terribly powerful drama series. I mean, it really is worth watching if you can. I've watched it once. I can never watch it again. I mean, it was traumatic because, again, for someone of my generation, had I come out in the 1980s, and I didn't, but had I come out in the 1980s, the assumption would be that that was a death sentence because, you know, that was the culture of the time. And just trying to convey that sense, I think, to a generation that has thankfully moved on from that. I mean, it's very difficult. And of course, people of my generation don't necessarily want to go back and relive that experience, which is why I think, you know, the role of culture in explaining this can be so important.
Was the assumption be that it was a death sentence simply to be gay or to have HIV?
Well, it was, frankly, at the time, it was assumed that to have HIV was a death sentence, particularly in sort of the mid-1980s. We didn't start to get retroviral drugs until right at the end of the decade. But from that, it was very a very easy leap to say, well, if you're gay, you will get HIV, and that will lead to AIDS, and then you will die. You know, at a time when there was considerable ignorance, particularly around the mid-1980s, when this was being referred to as a sort of gay cancer and things like that, it was, you know, the association was very, very strong. And of course, this led to a lot of the social attitudes that came out of that. And after a period where there had been increased inclusion in the 1970s, in the 1980s, a lot of overtly anti-queer legislation coming through here in the UK, horrendously. There was a government censorship of the queer community. In the United States, you get a lot of persecution. And that comes out of the association of HIV, and essentially gay men were the target at that time.
So where are we now? And this comes in two parts. Firstly, where are we in general? And secondly, has the change in attitudes been uneven, perhaps especially in relation to transgender people?
I think that society at large and business in particular have made a lot of advances in terms of diversity and inclusion. And the increase in acceptance, the increase in understanding of the queer community has been, I think, very important. One of the things that is quite positive here is that there is sort of a virtuous cycle. One of the things about prejudice is that prejudice tends to occur against people you don't know. The moment you humanize prejudice, prejudice starts to crumble away, because the whole principle of prejudice is that person is less than me. Or worse still, that person is less than human, which is also an issue. But as soon as you start knowing somebody who comes from a minority group who has a characteristic that is subject to prejudice, you realize that they're just like you, that they're, you know, they've got the same hopes and ambitions and flaws and everything else that all the rest of us have. And so that breaks down the prejudice very, very quickly. And we see this time and time again. So as we've got to a situation where more people are prepared to be out in the workplace, still not enough. I mean, it's still only about half of the working population who are queer will be out in the workplace in a country like the UK. But as that happens, you know, the person you're sitting next to at work, or the person, you know, you're sharing coffee with or having a conversation at the water cooler with, is gay, you realize that they're just like you, and the barriers disappear entirely. And that, I think, is very, very powerful, and it's becoming more and more widespread. So that, I think, is the positive development that we are seeing. My concern is that because we are going through a period of dramatic economic change, when we get these episodes of economic change, that does tend to encourage prejudice. And because the LGBTQ plus community has been one of the areas which has come up very, very rapidly in the last few years and started to get a lot more inclusion, that I think is going to be one of the first targets in this sort of environment. And that has to be a risk. And we look at some of the trends that are happening in the United States, for example. You know, there are some very worrying signs there. Russia is frankly quite horrific in terms of the direction of travel, some of the prejudice that's come through in Hungary and so on. I mean, you know, these are areas where things are not always moving forwards. There are areas in the world where we're moving backwards as well. With regards to the trans community, I think this again is an example of the importance of having more contact, the importance of better understanding, that unfortunately, you know, the trans community is an even smaller subsection of the LGBTQ plus community, which itself is a smaller subsection of society. And so the contact with trans men and trans women, with people who are intersex, people who are non-binary, is less frequent. And that means that perhaps prejudice is better able to flourish. But generally, that prejudice is coming out of ignorance, and so it can be tackled. I think it is proving difficult to tackle. And it's a bigger struggle in many ways than LGBTQ plus rights more broadly have been. I think there are some positive signs here. There are some moves forwards. And again, you know, the inclusion of trans people into mainstream culture and into social media, that is important because, you know, you may not know somebody who is trans, but you may follow somebody who is trans on YouTube, for example, or, you know, you watch a television program like the Netflix series Heartstopper, which features a trans actress playing a trans woman or trans girl. And again, you know, you get an emotional attachment to that. You realize that, you know, trans women are just like any other woman, and it's perfectly acceptable. So that sort of thing is chipping away in a broader sense, but I still think that there is further to go. People in the financial sector tend to have a good educational background. They tend to be urban-based. They tend to be more cosmopolitan in terms of their outlook. That sort of thing is helping, I think, with a lot of the inclusion. But it's not perfect. There's no question of that. But I think both in terms of, you know, the broader LGBTQ plus inclusion, but also specifically the issues for the trans community, you know, the financial sector is an area where there is some support.
And how has your experience been with LGBT issues at UBS specifically?
Well, it's like any organization, it's evolved over time. Our Pride Network in Switzerland celebrated its 20th anniversary this year. I have, since being out, I've had no overt homophobia or anything like that, and in fact have been very much welcomed in terms of the wider organization. I think that the culture of an organization like UBS is naturally very supportive, and I think that this is important in any organization. Having a box-checking exercise from HR is not going to create an inclusive environment for any disadvantaged group. Whereas having a genuine culture where people will stand up to defend the equality of colleagues, where people will look to learn and look to understand, improve their understanding, is very important. I think that leadership plays a very important role in this. Now, one of the things that I think is very important here is that, you know, we move away from sort of scattering rainbow glitter over the logo in the month of June and forgetting about everything, you know, the rest of the year. And this is an area where I think that UBS has provided a lot of leadership to the organization as a whole, has built the culture. So, for example, I wrote about in my book on labor market prejudice, UBS played a leading role in amicus briefs before the US Supreme Court in the Windsor case, which was against Defense of Marriage Act, and in the Obergefell case, which was for same-sex marriage equality. And UBS played a prominent role in filing amicus briefs in that. Back as far as 2015, UBS provided an enormous amount of support to me as an economist in those days in the investment bank to write a piece on the economics of marriage equality. And we were the only bank writing about this. It was, I think, the first bank even to come close to touching on this subject. And the number of colleagues who sent me emails or had conversations with me saying how proud they were that the bank felt that this was something it should be doing. And I think, you know, the attitude from bank management was, of course, we're going to do this. Why wouldn't we do this? But, you know, it sort of reinforced that culture. But I think what is important in building culture, and this is something that I've certainly experienced at UBS, is that on any diversity issue, leadership, I think, you know, is not necessarily going to be from the board of directors, as it were, or the chief exec. Yes, absolutely. The principles need to come from there. But to understand the challenges faced by a community, I often say, you know, what we need to see is not, you know, leadership with a rousing speech from the podium, but leadership is sitting at the back of the room, listening to what other people have to say, having a coffee with, you know, the graduate trainee next to you. And we had an instance of this recently with Zurich Pride, where Ralph Hammers, our chief exec, came along to Zurich Pride. And this wasn't sort of a drive-by. Ralph turned up with his wife, marched for 4 hours in 35-degree heat, no rousing speech from the podium. He spent his time talking to everyone who was marching in Pride from UBS, talking to them about their careers, about their experiences being LGBTQ plus at UBS and so on. And for me, that was a really, really telling instance of genuine leadership in this area, looking to discover more about the community, looking to discover about the issues of the community within finance, within UBS. And that's exactly what we need to see. And that, I have to say, after 30 years in the finance industry, one does develop a certain cynicism about life, perhaps. I mean, it's inevitable. But that, for me, was one of the best examples of leadership in diversity and inclusion that I have seen.
Corporate Pride has been criticized by people saying they don't want to see a parade of banks and insurance companies at Pride, but you've written in defense of it, Paul, and you in fact see it as a positive thing.
I do view it as a positive. The accusation is that companies are, here for the party, not for the protest. And there are companies like that. There are companies where, the rainbow logo disappears on the 1st of July, where, they're saying, no, we support Pride, and then they support anti-LGBTQ plus politicians, at the same time. So there's absolutely, there are, areas which should be called out. Having said that, I think that there are two areas where corporate involvement in Pride is so, so important, and where I think it actually needs to be front and center in the years ahead. The first is that we have to recognize that most people spend most of their adult lives working for companies. We don't work in the voluntary sector. We don't work for government. Most people work for companies. And the corporate culture is something we do take home. So if you're in a corporate culture where your colleagues feel safe to be out and proud, then you are a lot less likely to be homophobic, not just in the workplace, but outside the workplace. And if you're less homophobic outside the workplace, you will influence your friends and your family and so on. And so we have to recognize that the culture within a company has a really important role to play in shaping the culture of society at large. And I think that's extremely important. And so having corporates demonstrating their inclusivity is, I think, something which can really shape the wider society. The second thing is that, as I mentioned, with structural change in the economy coming, I think that there is a significant risk of rising prejudice coming through. This was the subject of my last book. It's something we've seen time and again in industrial revolutions. You get a lot of upheaval. People feel very disorientated, and they look for scapegoats to blame, scapegoat economics. Companies have not just a moral and a social issue, they have an economic argument against this as well. And I think companies are going to have to play a larger role in lobbying against prejudice coming out of political populism, scapegoat economics, and so forth. Now, that does mean that I think that on a number of issues that can be subject to prejudice, including many LGBTQ plus issues, companies actually can't be neutral. And eventually the company has to take a stand, because you can't be neutral on an issue of prejudice. Either you think people deserve equality, or you think some people are worth less than others. Now, very clearly, I and frankly the entire economics profession are on the side of equality. Companies ultimately want the right person in the right job at the right time. That's part of the profit motive. And I don't think there's anything wrong in using the profit motive to argue for diversity and inclusion. Frankly, I think you use every weapon in your arsenal to argue for diversity and inclusion. And the role of corporates in that, I think, is significant. So yes, I think corporates should be in Pride. I think we should call out companies that are being hypocritical. Absolutely. They should be judged in the court of public opinion, or even worse, the court of Twitter, and called out if they've got it wrong. But the companies that are creating an inclusive culture, that are fighting year round for
a genuine, diverse and inclusive society should be welcomed with open arms.
You have spoken about how economic upheaval can encourage discriminatory behaviour, including a specific story about how some of your relatives lost their jobs as dock workers in London and turned to fascism in the 1930s. Do you think that with high inflation, people talking about a cost of living crisis and continuing automation of jobs in the longer term, this could encourage more discrimination, including against LGBTQ plus people?
In any period of economic upheaval, what you get is a rise of scapegoat economics, because it's not actually necessarily about job losses, because we won't get net over time job losses. Yes, some jobs will disappear, but new jobs will be created. You know, the role of a podcaster did not exist 10 years ago. This is a new role, and it's been created by the technological change. So you get transition, you get change, but of course, not everyone can adapt to that change. And the critical issue here is actually less about employment income or anything like that. It's more about social status. Some people see their social status falling as a result of structural change. And what's worse is they see their neighbor's social status going up. And in that, you say, well, it's not my fault. My social status is going down. It's not my fault I've lost my job, or you know, my income has fallen. It must be the fault of that foreigner. It must be the fault of moral decline because gay men are allowed to marry. It must be the fault of immigration, whatever it is. You find a group to blame, because then, of course, you get the very reassuring and completely erroneous narrative that will take that group out of society and everything will go back to what it was. And so you get this nice, simple solution in a very, very complex world. So, yes, I think that unfortunately, because of the social change that we are going to be going through, we're already going through, we will see the rise of scapegoat economics and prejudice politics. These are, you know, go hand in hand. I think that companies can push back against this. I think individuals can push back against this. The optimistic case is as well that society has more weapons to push back against this overall. Groups that are targeted for prejudice can actually come together a lot more easily now than they could 20 or 30 years ago. You know, social media is often and rightly castigated for feeding prejudice in society, for creating negative echo chambers and so on. And it certainly does do that for some groups. But it also allows people to connect. It also brings different groups together. It means that, you know, if I can quote from an old UK sitcom, if you feel you are the only gay in the village in, you know, rural countryside, well, actually, you can find a network online and you can find people who you can have a relationship with. You can, you know, explain your fears and your hopes, and you know, you realize that you're not alone. And with that, you can fight back against the prejudice. So, yes, I'm afraid to say prejudice, we can see it now. It is rising across various areas. We're seeing this with anti-trans actions. We are seeing this with a resistance to marriage equality in the United States, possibly overturning Lawrence versus Texas, which establishes the right for queer people to have relations with one another. You know, this sort of thing is under threat, but at the same time, there is a far more powerful resistance to this than would have been possible 20 years ago. There are times when you look at the news, when you look at the reaction, and you can end up in a very dark and pessimistic place. One of the most depressing periods of my life was spent when I was researching for the book, looking at the US white supremacist movement and, you know, how they've adapted technology to their own ends. And you know, it's an awful, demoralizing story to go through. But there's also an awful amount of optimism and positivity, whether it is through podcasts or YouTube videos or other forms of social media, bringing people together. And on balance, and perhaps a little unusually for an economist, I err on the side of the optimistic.
There has been a lot of talk in financial markets about ESG, with the S meaning socially positive investing. What does this look like in terms of the LGBTQ plus community?
That's a very interesting question, because there is a fundamental problem for the LGBTQ plus community, for many groups which have prejudice characteristics, but for LGBTQ plus in particular, in that this can be an invisible form of prejudice. That is to say that assessing how many LGBTQ plus people there are in an organization or assessing a company's performance on that is actually quite difficult to do because people can and do disguise who they are. I mean, I spent many years in my career, pretending to be straight. And the consequence of that is still very negative because it's very stressful to have to lie about who you are all the time. And so it affected my performance and it was a negative for me. But I was in a culture where I felt I couldn't be out. Now, the problem is that you really do have a difficulty in getting data on invisible forms of prejudice. It's a little bit simplistic, but I would say essentially, if you share characteristics with other members of your family, you're more likely to be proud and public about those characteristics. So things like gender, ethnicity, religion, people tend to be more visible about. But if you don't necessarily share characteristics with other members of your family, then one of the risks is that your family is prejudiced against you. And there are certain forms of disability, for example, neurodiversity, and of course, sexuality, where actually the biggest sort of source of hatred may come from within your family. And for those characteristics, people are a lot more likely to be hidden. So it means that both in terms of assessing how people invest and acting as an investor, it becomes a lot more difficult to try and get a handle on the true method of inclusivity and is this company inclusive? Are they doing the right thing? It can be very, very difficult to get a handle on that. I think that if we look at LGBTQ plus people as investors, it is very clear that they need to think slightly differently from mainstream investors. In many cases, they will have less job security, so they may need to have more liquidity in their portfolio because they don't have the same legal rights and protections that other people have, and there's a number of countries where that is the case, in fact, a majority of countries where that is the case. They may need to think about their legacy. How do you manage your legacy if your marriage is never going to be recognized in the country that you're in, or the marriage recognition is going to be taken away from you? How do you manage legacy for your children? I mean, that's an important consideration. Longevity is also an issue. If you are part of a lesbian couple, the chances of one of you living to over 100 is a great deal higher than if you're in a heterosexual couple because of the nature of female longevity. So there's all sorts of complications here, and you can't assume that you follow the vanilla pattern. For investors generally, I think the importance of diversity and inclusion is increasing. You absolutely want a company that is both diverse and inclusive in the way that it runs its business. You want a company that employs the right person in the right job at the right time, because that's how they're going to maximize their efficiency, their productivity, their profitability. You also absolutely need diversity in decision making. If everybody sat round the table is a white Anglo-Saxon middle-aged bald man, clearly not a demographic I've got anything against, but if that's all you've got sitting around the table, you've got a monoculture of thinking. So yes, you need queer people, you need ethnic diversity, you need gender diversity to be able to examine a problem from all possible angles, particularly when the world is going through massive upheaval and there's a great deal of change, because we're throwing up more opportunities and more problems and more risks in a period of structural upheaval. And if you've only got a monoculture of thinking, you're going to miss the opportunities, or worse, miss the risks. And so that's where the diversity side comes in. So I think investors are going to be demanding more and more evidence of the S part of ESG. My own view, for what it is worth, is that when I look at diversity and inclusion, I think diversity and inclusion today as an investment focus is probably where sustainability was about 15 years ago. It's just starting to really come up as an issue. People are asking companies not only about their own diversity and inclusion, but about the diversity and inclusion of their supply chains, for example. So this is really starting to move on the agenda. I think that diversity and inclusion is likely to move up in terms of profile, probably even more rapidly than sustainability did, because it's also an integral part of sustainability. You know, one of the key solutions to the sustainability crisis is greater efficiency. Greater efficiency requires us to use technology, use our skills to the maximum possible benefit, which means right person, right job, right time. So if you have got a prejudiced society or a prejudiced company, not only is it likely to underperform economically, it's also actually likely to underperform in terms of sustainability metrics because it's just not going to be as efficient as it could be. So this is all wrapped up together. And I think, you know, this part of ESG is going to be moving very rapidly up investors' priority lists over the next few years.
I mean, as of right now today, do you think it's possible to create a kind of meaningful LGBTQ plus asset allocation? Do you say, I don't know, divest from Saudi Arabia, or even if certain laws change, Texas, or who knows?
I think so. It's a complicated question. I think that if we, as with sustainability, outright exclusion is not necessarily the way to go. Because what you want to try and do is improve the situation in the future. So a global employer may have offices in countries which are hostile to or extremely hostile to LGBTQ plus people, but it provides sort of an embassy within those countries. So, you know, talented queer workers know that they will be respected and treated properly within that organization, even if the world outside the walls is not great. Now, that's not ideal, but that's better than not being there. It's a lot better than not being there for the individuals concerned. So I think that there's an aspect where exclusion is to be resisted. I think what companies can and should do is lobby. And a charity that I work for, the Open for Business Group, actually does this, that they use economic arguments to promote LGBTQ plus equality, and they orchestrate campaigns by companies to lobby governments for change, to say, no, actually, equality is good for business, and this is where we want to go, because sometimes, you know, a government may not listen to the moral arguments, but if you put it in terms of hard cash, they'll start to pay more attention. So there are lots of ways, I think, where we can do this. So it shouldn't just be exclusion. I think you can start to look at companies' behavior. You can see, you know, do they have a pride network? You know, do they have visibility? Do they lobby for queer rights? Is there support in terms of their benefits policies for same-sex couples, even where not required? That sort of approach can all be included in an index. But of course, we still run into the problem that lots of people are not necessarily going to be out at work, even in an accepting company, if the society at large is not necessarily accepting. You know, I'm very happy at UBS to voluntarily, you know, identify as a gay man. If I was living in Texas, I'm not sure I want that written down somewhere anymore, not with the way things are going there. So you can see why you would have perhaps a more cautious approach in certain areas where the political climate is different, even if you're working for a very inclusive company where you know you're safe in the corporate. So it is going to be a problem. But I think that there are some metrics we can use that help us move forwards. Things like the HRC index from the United States, this does help. It's not perfect. But we can use indices which do help more or less in terms of judging whether a company is genuinely embracing diversity and inclusion, or whether it's just partying for June and forgetting about the queer community the rest of the year.
Do you think that there could be potential in the future that maybe you have people, say, boycotting government bonds from countries with specific laws? Because, you know, a government, you can see it's on their statute book, and maybe you're not depending on people identifying as gay. You can see what they vote for.
I think there is there is a potential for more coming from boycotts. And we've seen this already. And again, you know, the role of social media, the role of apps has increased the potential power of boycotts. In the United States, you saw a boycott of the fast food restaurant Chick-fil-A over their support for overtly anti-LGBTQ plus organizations. And that has led to some change in behavior. Debate how much has been changed, but there has been some change in behavior as a consequence. We've seen a number of apps come out which will give you some indication. You know, when you go shopping, you can scan a barcode and the app will say, well, you know, on the HRC Human Rights Index and queer inclusion, this company scores this. So there are ways where this is coming through. Government boycotts are not necessarily happening just yet in terms of government bonds. This may be something that comes through in the future. It may be something we start to get more of. Certainly, I think at the moment, a lot of the action is very dependent upon a consumer retail level. And of course, a retail investor tends not to be, you know, investing in obscure government bonds of highly prejudiced countries as a general rule. But we are seeing, for example, more and more issues around tourism and things like that, where there are boycotts of economies. I'm not going to visit that country because it's not safe for me to go there. This is something that will be coming through, I think.
What is the future of the LGBTQ plus community in banking? Are there certain steps that you would like to be taken still?
I think that we can always do more. I mean, one can always say that. I think that the LGBTQ plus community has achieved a higher profile in recent years. As we've been discussing, I think the trans community still needs to have further improvements in terms of its profile. I would argue that there are an increasing number of organizations like UBS that have really embraced diversity and inclusion as a key part of the culture. And, you know, where the focus is on the individual and the talent and the skills that they bring and not about irrelevant factors that have got nothing to do with their performance at work. So I think that there is a lot that is going on here. I would say that as I look around the industry, I think that there are still perhaps a number of organizations where diversity and inclusion, and particularly queer diversity and inclusion, has not necessarily become embedded in the culture. It is still, you know, the HR box checking exercise rather than something that, you know, is absolutely ingrained in the culture and across all levels of the organization. You know, it's not just the chief exec saying, this is what we must do. What you need is for the graduate trainee to turn around and say, that's not an acceptable comment to be making. You know, and for that to be an embedded part of the culture is where we need to get to, I think. It is also, I think, the case that there is still a lack of LGBTQ plus, or at least openly LGBTQ plus representation at the very top of organizations. This is not just banking. This is across all organizations. A report out recently suggested that, you know, of the, I think it was the Fortune 2000, 0.5% of corporate directors are openly queer. Now, given that the queer community is 10% of the population, roughly speaking, perhaps a little bit higher now, to have 0.5% of openly queer corporate directors is clearly an underrepresentation and symptomatic of problems. This may resolve over time. You know, as my generation moves on and the younger generation start to come up, they have had a more open and honest career in terms of their sexuality. Maybe that representation improves. But I would like to see more representation in senior management if we could get it.
The final question I had to ask you, Paul, is you've worked for a Swiss company for many years. Gay marriage in Switzerland actually only just became legal, I believe, this month, July 2022. What's your perception of Switzerland for these kind of things been? How does it compare to the UK or maybe other areas?
So I think, Switzerland obviously was moving towards marriage equality earlier, and then the Swiss referendum process kicked in, and has had civil union for a long time. And indeed, I've had friends and colleagues who have become civil partners over the years. Switzerland, I think, was a little slower to start than the UK. I think that much is clear. But has moved in recent years, I think, quite quickly in embracing the values of diversity and inclusion, particularly around sexuality. I think that the momentum is definitely positive. The Zurich Pride, which I attended this year, was a remarkably joyous occasion and very, very welcoming, not just for the participants, who obviously are all members of the same community and the allies, but actually just walking along the streets and people sort of leaning out of windows and support across the community. And it was very, very heartening to see. So I think that whilst perhaps Switzerland has been a little bit later, and it's probably still a little bit behind a country like the UK in terms of aspects, it has made a great deal of progress. And of course, no country is perfect. The failure of the UK government to accelerate its promised ban on conversion therapy, which is effectively a form of psychological torture, is reprehensible, and these things still need to be pushed here. It's always the same when we're talking about fighting against prejudice and discrimination. It's an ongoing battle. But I'm delighted to see that Switzerland has made as much progress as it has and has embraced marriage equality this year.
Thank you, Paul Donovan, for discussing the dramatic changes in attitudes towards LGBTQ plus people within banking. This is the final episode of the first series of CityWire Switzerland's Thanks, I Quit podcast. Re-listen to our previous episodes from the series to hear veterans of the scene, such as Klaus Wellershoff and Dirk Klee, discuss their careers, and look out for new podcast content from us in the future. Thanks for listening.